Good afternoon and welcome once again to What Comes Next Live. My guest today is Vanda Wieporska, who is the Executive Director of the Equality Trust. I have had the good fortune of meeting this wonderful person about 3 years ago, and I've learned an awful lot from her. And she's certainly a passionate individual with many things on the go at once. And I've not spoken to her for, I think, once since lockdown in March, but no, we haven't got together in person. Something to remedy when we're not so busy, as she said before we went live, one of these years. So with everything on your mind, I'm intrigued to see what we might want to learn from Vanda today over the next half an hour about what comes next. Pleasure to have you, Vanda.
Thank you. That's a really lovely introduction, and it makes me realise how long it has been since we've seen each other. Mm. Gosh. It's been quite a momentous time as well to not be in touch as well with all the events that have been happening over the summer. So, yeah, it seems longer than it was.
Yeah. So what's top of mind for you right now?
Well, short term, I've got a day off tomorrow and it's my birthday.
Happy birthday, 39.
So I have free time and I'm a bit bewildered as to what to do with it. As often happens, it's much easier to just go and sort of think about attacking the email mountain. But longer term, I think we're coming towards the end of this year, and it's a real time for reflection as to what has changed, what hasn't, where the energy is, whether the momentum will be continued from all of the various movements and things that have been happening this year. So it's a really kind of, those two things I think are coinciding at the same time for me as to, you know, where, what is next. And it's a scary but very interesting and exciting question. And I think one of the things is that, you know, so many people who work in change or in charities or in organizations that want to see change get quite scared when change happens. And I've probably said before that change doesn't usually come from writing a report, getting some media coverage, and then an MP suddenly or a PM suddenly adopts all your measures. You know, change is messy and dirty and goes forward and then goes backwards. And so it's really, really an interesting time to see how people react to change as well. Hmm.
The word that comes to me from listening to your opening thoughts is feelings and energy. And as I was taught years ago, emotion is really from two words, energy and motion, E-motion. And for me, I kind of spend a lot of time talking to a lot of people all over the place. And my work's around leadership and change. And I do wonder at the end of this year what people's energy is like and what it might be when it carries it forward into New Year. Because change doesn't happen because of rationality. I don't believe in that. I think it happens because people have a shift in feelings and a shift in energy. And so public sentiment, and you're quite a master at communicating some of those things with the different initiatives and being eloquent on television and public speaking and writing and stuff. But it does make me think about, I've had a lot of people feeling that they shouldn't be feeling uncomfortable right now, a lot of leaders in the last month or so, I should be fine. But there's a level of uncertainty fatigue, crisis fatigue, as some people are setting in, even those whose organizations, movements, businesses are in pretty decent shape and with good momentum going into the next year. So how do you rest, you know, and how do you reflect?
I think a lot of us feel that. And I think, you know, depending on the size of your organization or your responsibilities, you know, we've seen the fusion of home and office. Mm-hmm. We've seen the fusion of personal life and professional life. And I think those emotional boundaries and the wearing away of those emotional boundaries have had effects on us that we probably haven't really fully sort of consciously thought about as much as we ought to have done. And I think, you know, many of us were talking about this and saying, well, you know, one minute you're homeschooling your child, the next minute, you know, you're having an important business meeting, the next minute you're dealing with a member of staff, the next minute you're making lunch for your child. And so that flipping of energy, whereas if I go to the office and I'm in work mode and I'm not really flipping that energy as much as if I'm at home and working. So I think that's one of the things that we've seen a lot of. And I think it is a feeling of, you know, people have had to go through making people redundant, be much more agile than a lot of charities are normally able to be, having to deal with staff's personal issues as well as part of the job. And so I think, you know, there has been a lot more emotional energy around work than there previously was. And so I think, you know, that has, for good leaders and good managers, that will have had an impact on them, because, you know, you'd have to be pretty hard-hearted not to be empathetic and sympathetic, you know, when staff have these issues and working around that. And of course, you know, I feel in a sense at the moment we've got the worst of both worlds, because we haven't got the pleasures that we would have of being able to go out or do the things we normally do. But I think we've got back to the work levels that we had previously. And of course, you know, we can't sort of sit in the garden or sit in the park with that lovely weather that sort of sustained us over the first lockdown. So I think we're coming to an end. Certainly I feel I'm coming to the end of a very, very tiring year. It's been a very interesting year to see a lot of movement, but it's also absolutely draining. And I think that is change, isn't it? You know, change isn't something that just happens, as you said, you know, and we all sort of skip merrily on. It demands a lot of work and a lot of energy, a lot of thinking, but also a lot of emotion. So from the sort of cracks that we've seen in the summer, from the movements that we've seen gain momentum in the summer, the trick now is at this point where we've all got really quite low energy and we're sort of, you know, crawling towards the holiday is to really sort of re-energize ourselves and keep that momentum going, because, you know, next year is it's going to come whether we want it or not, and many of us will be really glad to see the back of this year. But on the other hand, we've seen some momentous change in terms of Black Lives Matters, in terms of a range of issues, in terms of COVID and highlighting inequalities. So, you know, there's a bit of step change in understanding. There's been a sort of turbo boost and a catalyst to understanding. I mean, I don't have to explain to people what structural inequalities are anymore, or at least very rarely. Whereas, you know, we were probably struggling before the pandemic to really highlight just how crucial the high level of inequality in the UK was. Now, I think many more people understand that and the implications of that. So now we can move on to that next piece of work. But it does mean that, you know, we've had to be very agile. As I think most organisations have been, we've all had to change the way we do things.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, for viewers and listeners now and later, tell us a little bit about the charity that you lead and what you are focused on now and into 2021.
Well, the Equality Trust was founded in 2009 by Professors Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson. They wrote a book called The Spirit Level, which basically said, I'm giving away the plot here, you know, plot spoiler if you're intending to see the book, but it's still a good read. In countries with high levels of inequality, income inequality, we also see levels of socially determined ills. So we've got higher levels of incarceration, of violent crime, of poor mental and physical health, of low levels of social mobility, low levels of educational attainment, lower levels of life expectancy. So a whole range of those things that we know we associate those with poorer and more deprived areas. And COVID again has shown us that, you know, the higher rates have been in the most deprived areas. The link between income and wealth and health, quite frankly, and other things. So, you know, the organization was set up by the academics, and that's what I love as, you know, a former academic myself, that they weren't content to see their work sit on a shelf or be in journals, but they set up an organization at the same time. And we've been campaigning for over 10 years on economic and now social inequalities as well. Mm-hmm. So we do a range of work from looking at CEO pay ratios to equal pay and gender pay and bonus gaps. We work with young people to support them to become campaigners and to campaign on the areas that they really feel strongly about. And we have 20 local groups around the country who look at inequality in their own areas and build campaigns in their own areas and lobby their local councils. And then we work at national policy level. So, you know, lobbying the government for an inequality reduction strategy and making sure that inequality really is, you know, something that is thought about by policymakers. Because, you know, if 2020's done anything, it's shown us that we are not capable of taking a real sort of hit like COVID or whatever else it may have been, and a recession, and we're obviously going to be hit by recession and COVID at the same time. But the fabric of our society is so sort of stretched, it's so threadbare, that that shock puts hundreds of thousands of people either into poverty or into debt. And, you know, our society just isn't geared up to take that shock, not for the most vulnerable.
So you may have told me this, or sent me a document I read that was about it, but some stat around something like 70% of the UK population has less than £400 in savings.
Right? Yeah, if their boiler went, or, you know, for some families, it's having to buy their kids a new pair of shoes or having to buy their kids a new coat. You know, all of these things, if these things happen, it's a financial shock that sends people into poverty or debt.
And we're, and this was before COVID, and we have, I think, approximately, like in the EU, just about the bottom level of statutory sick pay. So when we're wondering why people don't go back to work or they avoid tests, if your wife's a billionaire and you're the Chancellor of the Exchequer, you might struggle to empathize with that situation, right? In terms of your support packages, you know? But yes, that stretched us thin. So what you said earlier was that, so you have the academic background and the data and the movements, like, was it a couple of years ago, you got together some other organizations to promote it, and you did what, Fat Cat Friday, which is the third working day of the year and the day in which the average FTSE CEO goes beyond the average wage in like 3 days into the year or something, like CEO pay. But this is education around income inequality and wealth inequality. From what you're saying, you don't have to explain structural inequality to people so much anymore. Although God love John Amici for the constant way he keeps explaining white privilege to people, right? It just calmly, 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 and repeating it and repeating it and repeating it. And eventually more people understand it, right? And that's an example of inequality, but it's a different form of inequality, obviously. But if the education part has shifted forwards, does this change the direction you, so a two-part question, does it change the direction you take things in next year? And to what level do you look to coordinate more with other charities broadly in the same area? Because there is some significant overlap.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you've either read my mind or my board papers, which I'm in the middle of at the moment, because we have been funded by the John Ellerman Foundation to set up a coalition of third sector organised and voluntary organisations to look at and tackle structural inequalities, because I think a lot of third sector organisations have realised that they need to go to the root and the cause of the issues rather than just keeping the bandages on. So that's something we'll be starting out in January. And it started from a rather sort of, you know, it's the power of Twitter, really, isn't it? I sent out a bit of a snide tweet earlier in the year, and when the Marmot review 10 years on, which was a big review of health inequalities, and it was updated this year, when that went out, loads of people were tweeting and commenting on it. And I sort of semi-sarcastically said, well, if everybody who was tweeting about this joined an alliance to tackle structural inequalities, you know, wouldn't that be good? And then I just got overwhelmed with people saying, yeah, that's a great idea. So, you know, the sort of it's the danger of me on Twitter, I think. We've just started a partnership with the National Justice Museum, which is another result of me and Twitter. So I should probably be kept off it for a while. But that's something that we'll be doing. And also organisations have come to us and said, you know, we want to do this right. We want to get long-term change within our organisations, but also in the way that we are managing our programmes or supporting people. And so, you know, we were thinking about setting up a consultancy before this happened. And now that's really sort of, you know, got a lot of support. So we've had a lot of organisations come to us after the summer. So that's something that we are doing. That is part of our what next plan next year. I think it's interesting to look at how we started off looking at income inequality, and then we moved, when I took over 4 years ago, to look at economic and social, because although you mentioned white privilege and the fantastic John Amici, these things are connected. You know, it's no coincidence that when we look at who is at the bottom of the income group and why, and that's a whole other what next session, I imagine. So it makes sense to bring these things together when we have a gender pay gap, an ethnic minority pay gap, a disability pay gap, a class pay gap in the UK. Then obviously we have to look at those intersectionally. But I think it's really, really useful for organisations to be looking at that broader piece now. And what we've always been trying to do, you know, in a very sort of much more subtle than me on Twitter way, is to talk to organisations about, well, if you are giving out food parcels, how far back are you prepared to go upstream? Are you prepared to look at the causes of poverty? Are you prepared to look at the policy? Are you prepared to step further outside what you're doing to actually look at the root causes? So I think, you know, many more organisations now are thinking about that because, you know, we can't keep putting the bandages on. Obviously, we will keep putting the bandages on, but we need to get that change upstream.
Fantastic. So lots of change. One thought occurs to me about what's next around inequality is there is an absolutely looming, what the Americans would call an 800-pound gorilla, right, that nobody's willing to look at because they'd have to, you know, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? But it would be too big. And I read something recently that 40 years ago, and for those who might listen or watch not in the UK, Brits culturally have a massive attachment to owning their own property where they can. It's a huge part of people's sense of self and identity. Where they can, they like to own their own property. And in 1989, the average earnings in the UK, compared to the average house price, meant that you could buy a property for 2.4 times annual earnings. And at that point in time, because I had a property in 1989, and I was very young and I got my first property, you could get a 95% mortgage and you could get it on 3.5 times earnings, even though the interest rates were slightly higher. So, and I could do this off, at the time, my earnings were about average national earnings. I was quite a graduate, but quite young. Now I know some people in their early 20s who are earning far, far more, right? Fortunate enough to have huge earnings, way beyond the national average. And they're looking, and they don't have the bank of mum and dad. So they're looking at this and the recognition now that the average earnings required to buy a house in the UK is over 8 times national earnings. And because the banks are still in shock after their, well, complete loss of credibility in 2008, they're not willing to lend any money. In fact, a lot of the stuff that the Chancellor thought would work didn't work because unless you had a gold-plated balance sheet, they weren't going to lend you money, even if the government's guaranteeing it. It just wasn't going to happen. So we have enormous numbers of people, and it's just even more exaggerated now. And maybe I'm just super aware of it, who will never, ever be able to own their own home. It will never happen. And so without some very major wealth, not income redistribution, but wealth redistribution, we might have a revolution, but that's a bigger conversation for another day. But it just occurred to me.
But I think that premise is a real hangover from the 1980s, and it shows you how powerful Thatcher's mantra of everybody must own their own home was. Because, you know, back in those days, there was a lot more social housing. People were perfectly happy to live in social housing. Social housing was of a good quality. There was far more of it, and there wasn't an obsession with owning your own home. So, you know, everybody fell for that. Everybody was made to think that if you didn't have your own home, you were somehow, you know, emasculated, or you weren't a proper person and you weren't a proper citizen. So I think, you know, it's quite tragic to see that 40 years on, this is still the case. And of course, we don't have much social housing, and we have people renting absolutely vile accommodation for ridiculous figures. And the figure that you quoted for the average house in the UK, I'm sure I've seen figures, if you look at London boroughs, that would price it at way more than 8 times. You know, we're talking about 60 times or more.
Yeah, the average.
And so, you know, we are.
Yeah, just to jump in, the average price of a house in the UK is currently about £270,000 for a house in the UK. London is, of course, utterly surreal. Double that in most London boroughs would get you a flat, not a house, an apartment, not a house.
Yeah, probably a studio flat or a one-bedroom flat.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the whole issue is, and of course, you know, previously then we had in the 80s, we did have far more of a proportion of profit going to labour rather than, you know, rather than to dividends and shares. So, you know, you can see the story starting in the 80s, and you can see where we ended up. You can see what happened next.
I've on different shows, I've talked about how Milton Friedman is responsible for an awful lot of problems with Thatcher and Reagan, for creating this cult of self and everybody just looking after themselves. And I maybe I'm a bit Pollyanna-ish, but I really do believe, you know, humans do want community and they do want to care for other people. So, you know, one of the solutions that's been looked at, and I'm very interested in it, is the idea of separating land ownership from property ownership.
Mm.
And places like London, where the land is brutally expensive, if the land was held, say there's a lot of public land, if the land was held in public trust, but it was a collective went ahead and built 50 homes, it's quite stunning how little that would actually cost people. It cost them less than their rent of a toxic private, and I'm doing air quotes for the audio audience, affordable housing, we call it in London. Anyway, I'm diverging. So you've got a lot of things to look at. So it feels like you're looking to scale the impact of the thinking and the charity through collaboration, consulting, and other things. What? Yeah. What else? Not what else are you going to do, but what else pops into your mind?
Well, I think it is about looking at really what's going to happen in the next couple of months, because there are going to be huge financial shocks. And although we keep, I'm obviously using the royal we, me and Rishi.
He does work. He does work for us. We're voters, right?
Well, it's a certain type. You know, as long as furlough happens, we're really just putting off the pain, aren't we? I mean, yeah. Today we saw, you know, Debenhams collapse. We're seeing Arcadia collapse. We're seeing, I mean, a lot of the high street was pretty ready to collapse before COVID, but this has just hastened it on. We're seeing the huge impact of hospitality. And we know already that, you know, disproportionately those who are losing their jobs are on lower incomes and are women. You know, if you've got an office job or a research post or something like that you can do from home, that's absolutely fine. You know, it's great. And I feel really privileged that I have a job that I can do from home, even while I'm moaning about doing homeschooling at the same time. But, you know, this is a very, very unequal recession.
Yes.
The jobs are going to go mainly from the bottom. And we've seen, you know, with the Forbes billionaire report that came out last month, that billionaires' collective wealth has topped 10 trillion. And that some of that is down to COVID when we look at, you know, all of the online stuff we've all been doing as a result. So, you know, there are very clear winners and very clear losers. And, you know, it is that fact that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And if we don't really do something about that soon, then we know what happens when you have big financial disease, when you have a recession, when you have people with no jobs. You know, we've seen that as a historian, you know, we can quote numerous examples of that. But what we saw before COVID even was that there was civil unrest in many countries, in Chile, in Lebanon, the Gilets jaunes in France. So, you know, the beginnings of that unrest were happening already. And this is bound to, I think, you know, have an impact on that.
Well, I mean, we saw that with Donald Trump in a way, because it was this feeling of being disempowered among a certain part of the population. They thought, well, he'll give us the answers. He'll stick it to the man, even though he was the man, right? But not to have a conversation about him. But yeah, it's one of the things I've been noting for quite a while is, it's almost a historical reference, but in business and the economy, COVID will amplify and accelerate what was going to happen anyway. So the sort of retail high street news in the UK was that 25,000 jobs went in the last 24 hours at long established brands that were going to fail within the next 5 years anyway, because their models had not been updated. They'd fallen behind. The jobs will go somewhere else. The question is, do the jobs go to somebody who just wants to leverage his balance sheet and get very, very rich? Or does it go to somebody who wants to make a difference? You know, immediately occurred to me that when that big department store chain Debenhams went down today, there's another very big, long established British department store that is owned by the employees. And you would think its model doesn't work because it still doesn't do that much online. It's called the John Lewis Partnership, and it seems to still be doing okay. And they're finding a way to create community. They also, for the non-UK residents, they tend to have the most cool and killer Christmas ad every year on television. And perhaps part of that is because it's not just a marketing agency saying, here's how you can look kind once a year for a day.
I think though John Lewis and Waitrose partnership, and I do admire the model. I mean, they haven't given a dividend to their partners this year.
No, they have been struggling for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, they have been struggling. But I think also they're a very sort of solidly middle class brand. And, you know, what we're seeing is the hollowing out of middle class, yes, with the hollowing out of middle class jobs as well. But, you know, even if they get down to buying Waitrose essentials, they'll still be shopping in Waitrose because that will be the last thing to go. Because, you know, it's part of the status, isn't it? It's part of one's status that, you know, being middle class by definition means, you know, you're going to shop in certain places. And so these things are the last things to go. The second car might go, the fourth holiday might go, but by God, you know, Waitrose is still going to carry on. And it's what we cling to, isn't it? It's what people cling to. What are their non-negotiables? It's a little bit like the sort of, you know, saying that women will buy lipstick in a recession, because it's a, you know, it's one of those small things that makes you feel good.
Yeah,
and doesn't cost that much.
Affordable luxury. an affordable luxury.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I've noticed, I love your observations for a minute or two, is that the style of leadership. We've had the Prime Minister in, I have to say, England, because he doesn't actually legally doesn't represent the other countries in the United Kingdom in terms of public health, making pronouncements. But the key resonance for him is the word freedom. We can't do that because of freedom, right? And it's like America light. And you know, I was talking to some people, I'm from Scotland originally, I was talking to some people who went up there and came back, and they went, it's just different up there. You know, now there'll be the odd people who aren't following the rules, but there is a collectivism up there. And I think politically there always has been. I mean, if Scotland hasn't voted for Conservative government since the Second World War, all right, it's very different politically. It has a lot more collectivism. And how far does it go when you're living in your multi-million pound home in central London, and because of all the Second World War bomb sites, there's loads of social housing in amongst all the mansions, right? Which I quite like, the fact that there's a mixed, what, you know, you call mixed housing. But when those are deteriorating and you're just, you know, upgrading your bathroom for the 10th time and you've got three Range Rovers parked outside, you know, at some point one would have to hope that people sort of start becoming more human and like actually caring. And if there's one thing I could wish for in a Christmas wish, is that people just start acting more fair and decent. On my blog the other day, I highlighted a book called The Art of Fairness, which was referred, I can't even remember the author's name right now, but just came out, and he was the guy who got Tim Harford started writing, who's a very interesting thinker and writer for the FT. Mm. But really, you know, nice guys, using the phrase, nice guys can finish first along with the toxic ones. So, you know, for every Philip Green there, who's the guy who brought down all these retail jobs and sits on his 100 million pound yacht in the Hamptons last summer. But there can be some good people around. And whether in what you call the third sector, or I just call business, which is also a charity, also charities and government. But I don't know. Give me some positive thoughts for the new year. What can we build from the momentum we got this year in people's understanding and awareness of things?
Well, I think it's about supporting those movements and those causes that you believe in, and, you know, the good old fashioned word of mouth. I'm a very big fan of, you know, I've talked to people about all sorts of things in gym locker rooms, at bus stops, or, you know, sitting over literally some knitting. So, you know, I think it's really think about what you truly and not ultimately believe in, and what sort of a world you want to see, what really fires you up, and what you really care about, and talk to others about it and do something to be that change. Because, you know, we all help in different ways, whether it's donating financially, whether it's donating in terms of space or in kind, or, you know, supporting organisations. But actually, you know, what are you going to do that's out of your comfort zone that will actually really support that cause, that will make a real difference to you and to the cause? And I think that's, you know, a matter for everybody to think about, because, you know, if you're not part of the solution, you are part of the problem, in a sense. And I kind of really hate those hackneyed phrases, but I think that's absolutely true because, you know, there are no bystanders. We're at a stage now, I think, with climate, with society, with inequality, where, you know, you will not be able to look your kids or your grandchildren in the face if you have them 20, 30, 40 years now, 20 or 40 years down the line, if you didn't actually make a stand and commit something. And it can be scary. You know, there's many different ways to get involved, but it can be scary for people to actually get out of their comfort zone and become engaged. It's about engagement, because we can, you know, we can do all of the campaigning that we like, but if we haven't got engagement and commitment from people to actually take action, then, you know, really it's a Potemkin village, isn't it?
So I guess the lesson here is do something that makes you uncomfortable. What I'm referencing is the comfort zone, stretch zone, panic zone model. If you do something that makes you panic, that might be another thing. But the thing a lot of people were talking about in June, thinking we might all have Christmases together, is like when your racist uncle says something at the dinner table, don't just sit quietly for the sake of family. Say something. Right. You know, as an example of taking a stand, of course, there'll be no Christmases, I would think, for many people this year. But it's not going to create change if it doesn't make you feel a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah. So, and I think it's about you changing as well. It's not just about you initiating that change and making someone else change or something else change. It's you changing and being a bit braver, a bit bolder, because the world needs brave and bold people at the moment.
I think there was a bloke called Gandhi said something similar to what you just said.
There'll be letters coming in after that.
if there was ever time to be the change you wish to see, yeah. So with that, fantastic. Thank you. And may you enjoy your birthday tomorrow, your 39th birthday once again. and may you, if I could make one recommendation to you, is when you finish this call, start a piece of paper that says to don't and write at least one thing on it that you won't do tomorrow. And that way it'll create some space.
That's a very good idea. I should do that every day, actually, Tom.
You could take three things off your to-do list and put them on your to-don't list, then they're still on the list. I found that works quite well for a lot of people. Okay. Thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing you IRL, as the kids might say.